Broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com. The following program has been brought to you by Cane Vineyard and Winery. Cane Vineyard and Winery supports Heritage Radio and the growing movement to change how Americans eat and how we think about our planet. For more information, visit www.cane5.com.
I tell you why I can't find you. Every time I go out to your place, you gone fishing.
How you know?
Well, there's a sign upon your door.
Uh-huh.
Gone fishing.
I'm real gone, man.
You ain't working anymore.
Could be.
There's your hole out in the sun, where you left a row half done. You claim that hoeing ain't no fun,
but I can prove it.
You ain't got no ambition. Gone fishing.
Hi, this is Bernie Wides, the naturalist, and I wish I could have said that we gone fishing, but I haven't done that in a while. And my guest today is Paul Greenberg, who wrote this terrific book called Four Fish, The Future of the Last Wild Food. And we did a show a couple of weeks ago, the first show, and this is the second show. So we covered two fish in the first show. We covered the salmon, and we covered sea bass. But this book is so great, and such great stories in it, that you have to read the book to see what really went on. So I'm going to introduce Paul. Paul, say hi to everybody.
Hello.
Okay, and in this show, we're going to talk about two other fish, Paul, right? We're going to talk about codfish and tuna.
Yep.
Okay, so just as a way of introduction, just tell the folks why you picked these four fish.
Yep.
To write the book about.
Well, you know, as a fisherman, and if you love fish and you love fishing, you have an experience of plentitude of species and plentitude of nature that is much broader than what I found turns out to be the average consumers. I think, Bernie, you'd appreciate, you know, the idea of, like, when I was a kid, I used to sometimes with my fishing buddy, we'd have a competition. How many species can you catch, right? Not just,
right.
You know, when you get bored of how many fish, you know, you catch how many species.
Yeah. And then you run a pool for the biggest fish, right?
but the turns out the average consumer is much more limited in their perceptions. And what I found when I sort of did interviews with everyday consumers before I wrote the book was that people really tended to have kind of four flesh archetypes in their heads when they sat down to eat. Fish, you know, they always wanted to have something pink and succulent. That would be your salmon. They'd like to have something a little bit more substantial that they could broil, the white fish, and that would be your sea bass. They'd like to have something white and flaky that they could deep fry with a low oil content, and that would be cod. And finally, they'd like to have something that they could, you know, sort of steaky that they could grill or maybe do up as sushi, and that would be your tuna. So that's why I chose these four, you know,
right.
and oftentimes when people talk about this book, they'll say you chose these four species. Well, no, I chose four archetypes, four market names, you know, salmon, sea bass, cod, and tuna. Within each of those names are many species.
Right. So it's just the common names that we use.
Yes, exactly. And
right.
So each of them are kind of different lenses. Think of it as a four focal length camera looking at the ocean through the lenses that the average consumer understands.
Right.
So that's, you know, that was the sort
of framework. So that's it. Okay, so let's start off talking about cod then.
Yeah. Well, so cod is the, you know, the first real industrial fish. And part of it has to do with its qualities, its flesh qualities. Cod, as I mentioned earlier, have very, very low oil content in their flesh, which means that they are not apt to spoil. So cod you can dry, you can salt and dry, and it makes a very movable product. And in fact, if you've read Mark Karlansky's great book, Cod,
right, great book.
Great book. You know, he points out that cod is really one of the anchors of triangular trade. In colonial times, because
the Atlantic triangular trade.
The Atlantic triangular trade, because it turns out salt cod is one of the few proteins that you could readily transport without refrigeration. So you had manufactured goods going to Boston in exchange for products that would come up from the South that Boston merchants would trade, or textiles and so forth as well. But in turn, what got traded to the South was salt cod,
right?
Which fed slaves.
Right, slaves and everybody else.
And everybody else. But sure. But it was a major engine for the slave economy.
Right, because it was cheap
protein that was readily available, that was free, in fact, as far as, you know, there were so many cod in the sea that you could use them in that way. So anyway, so salt cod was the first way that it became industrialized, but the next wave was freezing.
Yeah, but before that, we can talk about, just briefly, about bacala or bacalao, which Europeans needed.
Yep.
I mean, so, you know, in the discovering of North America by the Portuguese.
Right.
That's a great story. We won't go into it now, but you should read the book and find out who really discovered North America.
I think it's actually the Basque.
The Basque.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah,
yes, I mean, the Basque and maybe the Portuguese.
Yeah, I mean, what Kurlansky put forward is that the Basque discovered America, but they didn't tell anyone because nobody gives away their fishing spot.
That's right. And until the Englishman found out, I don't remember which one it was. But anyhow, that's a great story. So bacala in Italian, I guess, and bacalao is in Spanish.
Yep.
And that's what we're talking about.
Yep.
Dried cod.
Yep.
And your grandparents may tell you about that they used to eat that.
Yep.
Right? Because
It
was a tremendous food source.
Tremendous food source. And if you didn't have refrigeration, you know,
before refrigeration
and freezers, you know.
It was pickling or salting or smoking or, or drying.
That's right. But, you know, cod made it into the post-refrigeration era because it's also, any fish with a low oil content also freezes well.
Ah, yes.
So, you know, like when I go codfish fishing, you know, I often go, you know, in wintertime, December, whatever, and I will fill my freezer, literally, and that fish will be good until July or August. If I did that with an oiler fish, like a bluefish, you wouldn't last a couple of weeks.
Or even a salmon. Well, salmon you could freeze, but not that well.
Yeah. It depends. You know, the key to freezing actually is having very, very low temperatures. Quick freezing. At very, very low temperatures, like minus 40 and below.
Flash freezing like they do when the factory shuts
down.
That's right.
But anyway, so I decided to look at cod because, you know, the first two fish that I looked at, salmon and sea bass, were kind of luxury items that through scarcity became aquacultured items and then in turn became common again. Cod is a different story because it was never a luxury item. It was always it was cheap and it was super abundant. So in looking at the ocean, the plights of the oceans, like what do you do when you start to lose the industrial fish, when you start to lose not the caviar, but
the workman's
but
fish.
The toast,
right.
You know.
Right.
You know, to some degree, some of the cod chapter is a little bit of a summary of Kurlansky's work itself. But then I started to look at, well, what are the alternatives? You know, if we've, you know, for those who aren't familiar with the codfish story, what happened is, you know, after World War II, you see a tremendous ramping up of fishing pressure. Fishing goes from a small local artisanal practice to an industrial endeavor to the point where we've quintupled the amount of fish we take from the sea in the last 50 years. You know, that's the equivalent of, so it's 90 million metric tons a year taken out of the ocean every year. That's the equivalent of the human weight of China.
It's the industrial revolution in the ocean.
Yes, yes.
And
it's the industrialization of a process of, it's the industrialization of hunting.
Right.
When you think about it, which, you know, many would argue should never have happened.
Mm.
You know, that the moment we went from hook and line to trawls and nets, that we were putting a force against a natural system that natural system could not sustain.
Mm.
So we did see successive large-scale cod collapses, the Grand Banks of Maine, of Canada being the most famous. One of the great cod grounds of the world just got tapped out, was closed in around 89. George's Bank, two large swaths of it were closed in the mid-90s. And it's really the fish that triggered this sense of fisheries crisis because it was a fish that was universally known and then it became universally scarce. Today, we're, you know, kind of in a situation where there are cod stocks that are rebuilding. Here in the States, there's been some pretty good legislation on fisheries. And, you know, a couple of years ago, I caught a codfish within the site of New York City skyline for the first time. So we're starting to see codfish trickle back. But in the meantime, the world has sort of moved on. Codfish no longer is the key player in that white flaky archetype.
Mm.
There are now other fish that have been slotted in. I often say, you know, a good way to figure out what's happened to to codfish and is to look at the fish sandwich. You know, to look at the
filet
fish
sandwich.
Because if you follow what's happened to the fish sandwich, the industrial fish sandwich, you can see where we've moved. Like, so the first filet of fish sandwich was introduced actually by a Cleveland franchise owner because he noticed on Friday all of his customers disappear because they were all Catholic. So he introduced a fish sandwich, the filet of fish, and it was made out of halibut, out of Atlantic halibut. And McDonald's owners asked him, you know, well, how much for that sandwich? And, you know, what do you want to charge? And I think he put the price point around 50 or 60 cents. And they said, well, you know, that's too expensive. We need a 25-cent sandwich.
Yeah, right.
And so he did cod. Now, the filet fish sandwich is no longer cod. It is now Alaska pollock.
Pollock, right.
And that's actually, by weight, the largest American fishery. It's, you know, a huge amount of pollock we take out of the Bering Sea, something on the order of 2 to 3 billion pounds a year.
So is that basically replaced cod?
It's, for most industrial purposes, it has largely replaced cod, although there are Pacific cod stocks that are not so badly off. It's a slightly different species than the Atlantic cod, but very closely related. And you'll see on menus sometimes Pacific cod.
Mm-hmm.
And generally, the Pacific fisheries are fished a little bit more sustainably than the Atlantic. The Atlantic has tended to be a free-for-all, whereas when the industrialization of the Pacific fisheries tended to happen after the age of fishery science started to ramp up its knowledge base. And so there's a better controls generally in the Pacific than the Atlantic.
Mm-hmm.
So pollock, is a big substitute. But the other fish that started appearing in fish sandwiches in lesser chains was tilapia.
Mm.
And most people don't even know what it is. But it is actually, it's a farmed fish from Africa.
Yeah.
And it grows incredibly quickly. You can go from egg to adult in 9 months. It will eat anything. It can tolerate a very, very broad range of salinity. So it has become one of the most widely farmed fish in the world, and it's relatively cheap.
Yeah, I think in Israel they farmed a lot of tilapia.
They did do it. Israel is one of the major. Israel in general was a major player in aquaculture development.
Right, but they say 70% of their fish were
farmed. Yeah,
were farmed.
And it's largely because of food security issues.
Right, sure.
You know, I mean, Israel, you know, was always from the start trying to figure out ways to tweak agriculture and animal husbandry.
Is that the same as St. Peter's fish?
It's not. I mean, they did call, the aquaculturists did call it St. Peter's fish, but again, like when we were talking about bass.
Yeah, the common names.
The common names don't necessarily correspond. I feel like the real St. Peter's fish is something else, but believe me, there's 7,000 species in the order Perciformes alone, so I can't keep track of them all.
When I was in Israel, that's what I went to that lake.
Yep.
I don't remember, it was Tiberias.
Sea of Galilee?
Yeah, and that's what they served.
Yeah.
And it was a local fish.
Yep.
So I said, that's great. And I thought it was tilapia.
It could be. I mean, there's a couple.
That's a problem we spoke about in the other show.
Yep.
Common names of fish are not necessarily the scientific names.
That's right. So, but tilapia how they got to us. Israel was a major factor in developing a lot of the science behind it. But the other thing that happened was that during the sort of post-World War II era, Peace Corps volunteers noticed that tilapia were this great development fish. You could throw it into a stagnant pond, it would eat the algae, and then it would turn it into protein, basically. So they're great fish for aquaculture. They grow very fast, and people realized that it was this way of getting fish protein onto the plate, even in the face of declining fish stocks. It's not, of course, you know, no solution solves everything.
Yeah.
And tilapia actually have a lot of negative aspects. They're very invasive because they can eat everything and live everywhere. If they get into any body of water that stays warm, tilapia can't tolerate is cold.
Yeah.
So any body of water that is above 60 degrees Fahrenheit, if some tilapia get in there, they will basically take it over in short order. And that's what's happened all over Southeast Asia, Africa, that these fish are really everywhere at this point.
Well, at least you can eat them,
right?
Not well, like lampreys or something.
No,
else.
That's true. And in fact, you know, a whole new range of eating has developed with seafood lately called invasivorism, where you're supposed to eat invasive species.
To get rid of them, right?
To get rid of them. I actually just was down in the Bahamas for Food and Wine magazine and hunting lionfish.
Lionfish, yes. When I was in Belize last winter.
Yep.
They pointed out the lionfish taking over the reefs.
Yep, yep, they are everywhere.
And encouraging people to eat them.
That's right.
The only problem. It must be a job catching them and cleaning them.
It is.
They have poison they have in the spines.
Venomous spines. Yes. And, you know, they are actually tricky to catch. I actually did scuba and catch them. But I calculated, just back the envelope calculation, that once we caught all the fish, because we were catching them for an invasive species dinner that the National Aquarium was doing.
Yeah.
Once we ran the numbers, I figured it was about $100 a pound.
Yeah, sure. That's right.
For a piece of fish that basically tasted like, you know.
Yeah, like any other.
You know, like a snapper or whatever.
Yeah. It must be a job to clean.
You know what? They are.
Do you skin them?
First, the spine, the venom is only in several of the spines.
Those big spines up,
up in the top, and then I think some of the ventral spines.
Okay.
So you clip them off.
Yeah.
Once you've clipped them off, then you just treat them like a sea bass.
Okay.
You just, you know, fillet them anyway.
Okay.
It's no big deal.
Let's get back to the...
Yeah, sorry. we digress.
We want to save some time in the show to talk about, you know, the futures.
Yep, sure.
But let finish up, you know, talking
about the cod. Yeah, so anyway, so what you see now is, you know, we have a choice in front of us. You know, should we continue to industrially fish cod-like fish like the Alaska pollock, where we take 2 to 3 billion pounds of fish out of the sea every year, where, you know, they say people who certify these sort of things claim that fishery is sustainable. Or should we be looking at fish like tilapia that work well on the farm, that can, you know, stand up to sort of industrial scale animal husbandry? The question is, do we want industrial fishing or do we want industrial farming? It's the answer is not so cut and dry.
Each one
causes problems. But I guess if I were to make a choice, I would like to see industrial fishing scaled back and careful aquaculture being done with, you know, a fish like tilapia that, you know, is a good candidate for aquaculture because it doesn't require fish meal, grows really fast. It's a good way of putting protein on the plates of people that need protein.
Yeah, and you mentioned some others in your book too.
Sure.
We can.
There's a fish called... you know, this is another tricky name
thing.
With
the names, yeah.
So there's a catfish, my colleagues in the South would loathe my calling it a catfish,
yes,
but there's a Vietnamese fish.
A tra?
Called a tra. Well, it's the genus is Pangasius, and the industry generally speaks of Pangasius.
Pangasius, right.
And it's very fast-growing fish. There are two species, Pangasius bocourdi, and I can't remember the other Latin name, but... Bassa and Tra are the two species of Pangasius. Tra are interesting because when you crowd them into a very tight space, they just stick their mouths above the water and they breathe air.
I think some carp can do that too.
Some can, yeah. I mean, well, there's a whole class of air-breathing fish.
Yeah.
Actually, I don't know about carp, but...
Like koi, you see sometimes a koi will come up and gulp some air.
Yeah. So anyway, this again is a good trait for aquaculture in the sense that like you don't have to worry about aeration so much if they can breathe air.
Mm.
And again, you see just like the tilapia, the Pangasius, we don't see it that much in this country, largely because of a real error that I think the Vietnamese made in branding the fish. They sold it as catfish.
No.
And of course, the U.S. catfish farmers hated that. Huge, political pressure to stop the importation of Vietnamese catfish, and finally forced them to actually not—they're not allowed to name their fish catfish.
Hmm.
So for a while, they tried to sell it in this country as Bassa and Tra by their Vietnamese names. That didn't seem to take off, and lately I've noticed it's re-entered the marketplace as Swai. Have you ever seen Swai in the markets? Swai. Now that I've told you, I think you might see it.
Swai, okay.
And this is this same fish, rebranded yet again, but it's now the 9th or 10th most popular fish in America.
Really?
And probably not because of consumer choice, it's just an institutional fish. You know how like you go to a hospital
and
you have fish?
That's it. Used to be pollock.
It used to be, you know.
Or was it cod?
Or it used to be cod, but now
or haddock.
Oftentimes that fish, the nameless fish,
yeah.
A lot of times it's tilapia or swai.
Yeah.
So... So if you look at the whitefish industry, you know, it used to be once upon a time, you know, if you did a pie chart of whitefish, like 99% of it was cod.
Yeah.
Now, it's equal parts Alaska pollock, tilapia, Pangasius catfish, with some others thrown in there, Pacific cod, haddock, things like that.
Yeah.
But it's a much more diverse set of species that we're eating than we used to.
Yeah. Forced to the decline of cod, basically.
Yes.
If you go back in history.
Yep.
you know, if I mean, you were from Connecticut, you weren't like in Massachusetts where the codfish is on the top of the
statehouse, right?
The was it a weather vane? I think
yeah, I think so.
Yeah, it's an important fish.
It's it's iconic species, and you know, one of the scientists I spoke with said, you know, the only equivalent loss of a vertebrate that we have on this continent is the bison, is the American buffalo.
Mm.
You know, we've lost as nearly as much biomass in the loss of cod as we lost in the biomass of bison.
Yeah, right. Okay, so we're going to have one more segment and we'll talk about tuna.
Yep.
And other methods that we're evolving of growing fish, raising fish. Should we have wild? Should fishermen be herders, or should they be farmers?
Mm-hmm.
Right. So we're going to sign off, take a short break, and my guest today is Paul Greenberg, who wrote this great book called Four Fish: The Last of the Wild Food. And we'll be back in a minute. So stay tuned for the next exciting adventure. We're going to talk about the only fish that is a warm-blooded fish. Hi, this is Bernie Wides back on the air for the second part of this second show on fish, and my great guest, Paul Greenberg, who wrote this terrific book called Four Fish, The Future of the Last Wild Food, and I would recommend it to anybody who has an interest in fish or in the fish as seafood or fish as recreational fishing or just loves fish anyhow, like my friend who has a 150-gallon saltwater tank. I mean, he is a real fish fanatic guy, but that's it. So anyhow, we've spoken about three of the four fish, and the last one we're going to talk about is bluefin tuna.
Yeah.
And the tuna family. And then we'll save some time at the end to wrap it up.
Yeah.
Okay, Paul, so tell us about tuna.
Well, you know, tuna, for me, as an angler, were the last frontier, the final frontier. Right. Have you been tuna fishing?
I went once, like you did. I went to Hudson Canyon.
Yep.
And spent all night out there.
Yep.
I'll tell you that at lunch because it's a long, it's a great story. I almost got pulled in the ocean. But it was very exciting.
Yeah, I mean, tuna are amazing creatures. I think in the progression in my book, I go from salmon to sea bass to cod and finally end with tuna because each one represents a step further and further out to sea. So, you know, if salmon represent the sort of Chinese food delivery of fish, they swim up through our rivers into our face. Actually, when I was counting salmon in Oregon, they were telling me, this was back when I was a kid, one year there was a flood and the salmon started swimming up the streets and trying to spawn in the streets. But no, tuna, though, are the other extreme. Tuna cross the ocean. The bluefin, the Atlantic bluefin, crosses the ocean from the Mediterranean to the coast of the United States and back again. Pacific bluefin, because remember, there are three species of bluefin, Atlantic, Pacific, and Southern. So the Pacific will go from California to Japan and back again. The Southern bluefin circles the bottom of the world. And all the tunas, there are 23 species, I think, 22, 23 species in, that are called tunas. All of them are very, very far ranging. The yellowfins will go, you know, down the coast of Africa and on one side and down South America on the other, you know, albacore all over the place. So they are kind of the stateless fish. Because they're so widely migratory, they're very difficult to manage. You know, the key point with any wild fish, if you want to manage them, you need to know, A, how many there are, and B, how many people are catching them and how much are they catching. It's very simple math to some degree. If you don't know how many there are, and if you don't know how many people are catching, how can you possibly come up with an equation that will lead you towards sustainability? Another sort of overarching fisheries thing people need to know is that, you know, when fisheries scientists talk about, you know, stock collapse or the size of a stock or whatever, it's all based on models. Nobody actually goes out and counts every fish in the sea. Yeah. They do extrapolations. They'll sample a few and they'll say, well, based on this, blah, 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 we think that there's this many fish. Well, the further ranging the fish are, the more difficult the model is and perhaps it's lapsing from, you know, veracity. You know, add to it the fact that many, many people are fishing these fish at the same time. You know, whereas, you know, say, for example, a species like American striped bass, one of the reasons we were able to engineer recovery with that fish is because it's fully contained within the territorial waters of the United States.
We had control over it. Yeah, now out to 200 miles is our...
Out to 200 miles, right. Mm-hmm. With tuna, you know, if bluefin tuna, you know, spends a key portion of its life in the Mediterranean, you know, they're... couple dozen countries surrounding the Mediterranean, and all those people got a chance to fish these fish. So very, very, very hard to regulate. And, you know, so those are the sort of policy issues. Over and above it, there are sort of what I would call wildlife issues with tuna, in the sense that these are really magnificent fish. I mean, the bluefin can be, you know, well over 1,000 pounds, well over 10 feet. And one thing a lot of people don't know is that they thermoregulate. They're warm-blooded. Mm-hmm. And they can raise their body temperature as much as 20 degrees above ambient. The yellowfin and the big eye also can do this. Mm-hmm. So that's very interesting. And the other thing is that they're very fast. A bluefin can swim over 40 miles an hour. So it's sort of like, you know, if you apply sort of what to me symbolizes wildlife? Let's say a cheetah. Fast. It's kind of warm, you know, cuddly.
Right. It's top predator.
It's beautiful. Yeah. And you look at a bluefin, and all those things apply. I mean, one of the great tragedies of fish is that if you're not a fisherman, you never really see the way that fish look fresh out of the water. And I think if you are a fisherman, that's one of the most exciting things. A fish fresh out of the water is gleaming with life. Even a sort of dullish fish like a bluefish, when it first comes out of the water, it's sort of iridescent green. And bluefin are literally alive with color. You know, like it's like they have all these, the major game fish out there do this thing called lighting up, where literally they have phosphorus in their skin. And like when a marlin or a bluefin or you know, other tuna charge a bait, they'll literally turn bright colors. And when you get them fresh out of the water, it's like their colors are literally dancing over the across their skin. So, you know, if you have this creature that is so beautiful, so enigmatic, so and increasingly so threatened, what's stopping us from calling it wildlife? Why do we continue to just call it seafood? Which, you know, is one of the kind of crueler words out there. Yeah. You know, it's like we don't call everything that we eat from the land, we don't call it land food, and yet everything from the sea is lumped into this category called seafood. So anyway, I guess when I decided to take on this chapter and look at tuna, that's where I sort of ultimately wanted to find out, you know, where to go with all this. Yeah. We're having a rock and roll concert outside as we speak. Maybe it's just in celebration of how raucous a tuna is. But
it could be. You said those dancing tuna.
That's dancing tuna.
Remember
exactly.
Charlie the tuna?
Yeah, right. Exactly. Oh, you know, it's interesting though. Actually, there's actually a campaign that Greenpeace is organizing right now.
Yeah.
Where they've co-opted Charlie the tuna, the mermaid, and the bumblebee. If you Google Greenpeace tuna campaign, it's pretty funny, and they've made the mermaids smoking.
Oh, really?
And Charlie is kind of like a kind of dodgy little creature. But they're basically, Greenpeace is launching a major campaign against something called FADs, F-A-Ds. They're called floating aggregating devices.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
And what these do is you dump a piece of styrofoam out in the middle of the ocean, and because there's so little structure out in the open ocean, fish are drawn to these aggregating devices, and it makes them very easy to catch. And so Greenpeace actually launched a big campaign to stop the use of floating aggregating devices because it's a major threat to overfishing and tuna.
You mean they have time and they're not chasing the Japanese whalers anymore?
you know, it's a huge organization now, so they have a whole whaler chasing unit.
They have a unit, right.
Actually, you know, the people who are being most active about the whale chasing, who have also gotten involved in the bluefin fight, is an organization called Sea Shepherd. And,
oh, yeah,
you know, in the whale warrior stuff that you might have seen on television.
So their boat, the Sea Shepherd.
Yeah, and I think the founder of Sea Shepherd was originally with Greenpeace. But, you know, with the bluefin, so getting back to the bluefin, you know, you've seen tremendous overfishing of Atlantic bluefin, and they've declined by as much as 80 to 90%.
Yeah.
And last year, in an effort to try and draw some attention to this, finally, the Greenpeace boats did get in the water, and instead of going after whalers, they went after tuna fishermen. And there was this whole thing that happened in the Mediterranean last spring where they launched a bunch of boats at a tuna purse seiner had just enveloped a school of tuna with a big net.
Yeah, tell people what purse seining is. Yeah,
purse seining is like, it's basically, imagine an old, it comes from the old style purse, you know, that you remember you would wear on your belt, and it would be just a bag.
With drawstrings
to close it. And a purse seine finds a school of fish, encircles it, and then draws the seine closed, and then pulls the fish inside. So what Greenpeace was doing is they found out when it was a French purse seiner had found a school of bluefin, and they roared out and tried to cut the seine so that the fish would get out. They didn't succeed, but in the process, one of the Greenpeace kids got stuck with a grappling hook because the fishermen were throwing grappling hooks at them. I mean, in all fairness to the fishermen, I think they were like, who are these people coming at them in like day glow outfits? And, you know, there's been a lot of piracy in the Mediterranean,
and I
think there was a lot of confusion going on. But, you know, it got ramped up, and then I think Sea Shepherd did a similar kind of action where they actually did manage to free some of the tuna and, threw rotten eggs at the... So it's stepping up to a larger fight.
Well, it brings up attention to the public what's going on. That's important.
Yeah.
I don't know how much of a dent they've made in this Greenpeace.
There are amorphous things that they're trying to do with bluefin tuna. One thing that people are calling for is to create a series of marine protected areas in the Mediterranean where bluefin spawn.
There isn't any now.
Not really around the spawning areas.
But you have all those different countries around there.
Yeah, and marine protected areas are a very young thing. You know, currently we protect about 10% of our land mass.
Yeah.
But
we just did one off the Hawaiian Islands.
Yeah.
Bush did it.
Yeah, yep. Yeah. Papahanaumokuakea is the name of it.
Oh, yeah?
Okay. Largest marine protected area in the world, or was at the time. We only protect about 1% of our ocean holdings. And, you know, if we transition into discussion about sort of solutions, that is, I think, one of the key solutions is we need to start putting aside portions of the ocean that are key to fishery productivity and keep them as places where you don't fish.
Yeah, that's one of the main emphasis that we should emphasize, to say that we need reserves like we have for other animals.
Yeah.
Like the national parks.
Yeah.
You can't hunt the national parks.
That's right. And you know, the thing is, I mean, it's slightly different than the national parks in that, you know, we don't create an elk preserve because we want to eat the elk. But it actually makes a lot of sense when you think about it.
Sure.
You know, one of the keys to protecting fish viability is you have to protect the large individuals. The larger the individual generally with fish, the more eggs they produce. You know, the large females produce a lot of eggs. They're very key producers for the species, key sort of engines of reproductivity. Well, there's no real fishing method that excludes those big fish. You know, trawling will get them. You know, you can create trawls that will exclude smaller fish, but it's going to catch the big fish. Long lining is going to catch the big fish, and they'll probably be dead by the time you bring them into the boat. Hook and line, yes, you can release some big fish, but there's still some mortality that occurs. The only real way to protect the big spawners is just to have an area where you won't catch them.
Right.
And so going back to this elk, you know, elk in the national park metaphor, is different because what we're really creating is a seafood bank account.
Right.
We're trying to create
that's
these,
a good way to look
you
at
know,
it.
These places that
investment in the future,
an investment in the future places, mm. you know, that you know, key areas. You know, we should be really actively trying to identify where are the keys, where's you know, spawning happening, where's it happening in important numbers, and kind of putting a fence around that because you know you wouldn't want to like basically if it was a bread factory, you wouldn't want to you know be scooping out large amounts of dough in the fermentation vat. Mm. You know, you'd have less bread in the end. And, you know, so that's sort of, yeah. you know, the equivalent.
So we are doing some of it now.
We are, I mean, you know.
Like the banks were closed for a while.
Right? Yeah. Well,
I don't mean the Citibank. Grand Banks and George's Bank.
Yeah, Grand Banks, I believe, is still closed. George's Bank, large portions of it are still closed.
Yeah.
And that's not exactly a marine protected area. That was an emergency closure.
Because everything was crashing.
Yeah. But permanent marine protected areas are starting to appear. This large one that George Bush created, Papahanaumokuakea, I was actually at the dedication ceremony. And, I mean, I wrote a piece about it for the New York Times. And I ended up calling that low-hanging fruit de mer. Because, you know, low-hanging fruit.
Oh, okay.
It was already a national monument, mm-hmm. and so to move it up to a full scale...
It was easy to do it, right?
Yeah, there weren't a lot of fishermen involved. It gets thornier in places like the Gulf of Mexico or Georges Bank or Stellwagen Bank, where you know, there's a lot of people still fishing there, and you actually have to push people out and say, no, this is not a fishing area.
Yeah.
You know, and that's actually, with Georges Bank, you mentioned, that's a big question going forward. Should those closed areas of Georges Bank just remain closed forever?
Hmm.
And maybe that those shouldn't be fished ever.
Yeah, make it a real sanctuary.
Yeah.
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 Well, they're doing it with some of the reefs too.
Yep.
So, but that's smoke sale. We don't get a lot of food fish from the reefs. So.
You know, it depends on the cultures, yeah, but I mean, yeah. So marine protected areas are a key part of it. I think, you know, there is this ongoing question of industrial fishing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I remember I was talking with Mark Karlansky once and he said, you know, I'll tell you how to get rid of the whole thing. You know, how to solve the whole problem. Outlaw bottom trawling. Just make it illegal.
Mm.
So, you know, there's no bottom trawling. So it's an interesting idea. No bottom trawling. So you're not tearing up the bottom. Mm. You're not getting all this bycatch, you know, accidental fish
right.
caught. But what does that leave you? Well, that leaves you with hook and line. And you're not going to get the kind of volume you get
right.
from trawling.
Yeah.
So then comes the question, well, okay, so if we're going to switch to hook and line, then where's the fish sticks going to come from? Mm. Where's the mass-produced fish?
The industrial
Where's fish. The underfish? And then you could answer that two ways. You could say, well, maybe there shouldn't even be that. Maybe we shouldn't have... Maybe, you know, if you're going to outlaw bottom trawling, maybe you should outlaw the fish stick.
Mm.
But if you're going to say, well, we need the fish stick, you know, it's an important source of protein, then maybe we should be looking at these aquaculture species like tilapia, like
right.
pangasius, that can be produced on a large scale with minimal amount of fish meal, that can potentially be grown in containment.
Closed systems.
In closed systems.
I think we should emphasize
yeah.
the closed system part.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, we really need to figure out a way to get wild fish from interacting with farmed fish. And I think towards the end of my book, I throw out the example of, like, the American striped bass.
Mm-hmm.
You know, striped bass, 60% of striped bass that we eat now are farmed.
Yeah.
But what's interesting with that is farmed striped bass are a hybrid. They're white bass, striped bass hybrid. They're effectively sterile,
mm-hmm.
and they are farmed largely in ponds.
In freshwater. Even though they could live in both.
Even though
they're wild ones.
Yeah. Well, you know, they're anadromous.
Anadromous, right.
So those fish, you know, so you have a situation where you have a striped bass population that, until we had some overfishing issues in the last few years, but was steadily rebuilding, and a farmed fish sector that was growing and mm-hmm. doing well. So you reach sort of a compromise, you know, where the wild fish, or the farm fish don't affect the wild fish, and in fact actually help the situation because, you know, what's, you know, if you see striped bass in the marketplace...
Takes the pressure off the wild fish.
Takes the pressure, and yeah. where was it taking the pressure off? Those little fish. Remember striped bass? You used to get a wild striped bass that was like, you know, 18 inches long.
Mm-hmm.
You don't see a wild striped bass in the market anymore because, no. like that size, because it's illegal.
That's right.
But what's serving that role is now the farmed fish.
Farmed fish, which is about a pound?
Pound and a half to 3 pounds, you know.
Pounds, yeah.
And so that those fish, you know, you wouldn't want to take those out of the wild because a fish that small wouldn't have had a chance to spawn.
Yeah.
Whereas a farm fish that size is reaches that size
that's the market size
in an economically acceptable time frame. Right, right. So it's a good compromise. So if we could reach that compromise with other species, then I think we might be heading towards something positive.
So I agree with you. We have to question industrial fishing.
Yep.
Right. And maybe cut down on the amount. Put these protected areas.
Yep.
So we'll have a sustainable crop over the years.
Yep.
Okay. And the other thing we have to do is, if we're going to farm them, let's do it on land.
Yep.
Away from the ocean.
Yep.
And ponds and tanks. Like the company I visited, they use like these huge swimming pool, above ground swimming pools.
Yep.
They have millions of fish there.
Yep.
And it's a closed system.
Yep.
They make their own salt water, so they don't have to worry about PCBs and all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. There are problems with the feed.
Mm-hmm.
I know, because it's still a conversion factor.
Sure.
Which they're trying to get down all the time.
Yep.
But
there we have places to go. I mean, I mentioned at I think in an earlier program that it can take as many as 6 pounds of wild fish to make a pound of farmed fish. With bluefin tuna, it's even worse. You know,
oh, sure,
it's 20 to 1. But there are actually fish substitutes that they're developing, ones that can be made synthesized from algae.
Right.
Other ones that can be synthesized from barley malt. Other things that can be synthesized from the sludge from breweries.
Right.
They can grow a bacteria on it that produces a nutritional profile similar to fish meal.
Get those omega-3s.
Yeah. Well, you can do it. You know, and here's
with algae they're doing it.
Yeah.
Now. Right.
Yeah. Well, you know, fish don't make omega-3s.
No,
actually.
They eat it.
They bioaccumulate it just like they bioaccumulate mercury and PCBs.
I know. In the company that supplies Local Oceans, they are raising rotifers.
Yeah.
To feed to the little critters.
Yep.
And they've enriched rotifers.
Yep.
So it's a great concept.
Well, that's what you do in the early life cycle.
Little babies.
Yep.
Yeah.
But I mean, I think solving the feed problem, you know, is
key to it.
Is really, really key to it.
To make it, worthwhile doing it. And you're not destroying the food chain of the ocean.
That's right. You know, and there's if the big fight in the ocean has been over these iconic fish, cod, tuna, marlin, and so forth, the next big fight, I think, is going to be about protecting the bottom of the food chain.
Right.
Things like menhaden or bunker, as you probably grew up calling them, which, you know, is being removed at rates that I think are unsustainable.
Absolutely.
Being reduced into fish meal, into paint and all sorts of industrial chemicals. River herring, which have markedly declined because of small dams everywhere. So that's another, I would say, my final point is that we got to protect the bottom of the food chain, try and rebuild the bottom of the food chain, because we've got more little fish at the bottom, we're going to have more big fish at the top.
Right. So it comes up to preserving the whole ecosystem.
That's right.
Right?
Ecosystem-based management.
Which we're about time facing, that we really have to do that.
That's right.
We can't do it piecemeal.
That's right.
How's that? Piecemeal, not bad for... So it's true. So there are a lot of problems, but if we want to continue eating fish, we're going to have to approach it all these different things and see which works best for which fish.
Absolutely.
To do. That's your message, right?
I would say, Paul? That's my message.
Okay. So I want to thank Paul Greenberg for coming today, because he's a terrific guest, and his book is terrific. So as I said, anybody has an interest in fishes or fish food or eating or whatever it is, or curiosity, I buy your book. It's in soft cover and hard cover. And you can get it in your local bookstore as well. There are still local bookstores and endangered species.
And if not, get it on your Kindle.
Get it on your Kindle. Right. So, Paul, thank you for coming.
Thanks, Bernie.
Okay. We'll sign off now. And remember, this is part two. Part one was 2 weeks ago. And we're signing off the air. Gone fishing
by a shady, weighty pool.
Shangri-La. Really loud.
I'm wishing I could be that kind of fool.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.